Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 355, Monday, February 3rd, 2020.
It does appear that when you insist on moral purity, you end up eating yourself.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. Today is the Iowa caucuses. Tonight, I should say. A couple days from now, the impeachment proceedings will culminate in the foregone conclusion. And last night, I watched the Super Bowl. I normally don't follow the NFL. I don't normally watch the Super Bowl, but I did grow up in Kansas City, Missouri, so I was pretty much required to watch the Chiefs play in the Super Bowl. And man, what an ending. Anyway, I'm happy for my, you know, my classmates and friends who are either still in Kansas City or still invested in the icons of Kansas City, like the Kansas City Chiefs. It is a happy day for Kansas Cityans. Alrighty, in this episode of the podcast, I'm going to talk with Ed the Willing, otherwise known as Ed Casimir, and the reason for Ed's inclusion here in the podcast and who he is and, you know, how he stands in relation to you, the audience, will be made clear early on in our conversation. So let's just jump right into it. Hey, everybody. I am on the line with Ed Casimir, who a long, long time ago, 10 years ago now, I think, put both Neil Kramer and me up in his apartment in Montreal at the very beginning of the Manifesting in Meatspace tour. No, was that it? No, it was the Transitional Alchemy tour. Manifesting in Meatspace was 3 years later. Ed, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you, Camo.
I put out a video a couple days ago where I was talking about Star Trek Picard, and I hadn't put one out in like a week because I was kind of down in the dumps and not really feeling it. And your response was, yeah, what about the coronavirus? What about impeachment? And I didn't know if you were kidding or not, because I don't have much patience whatsoever for this whole impeachment show. And I am really sensitive, I think, to fear-mongering these days. I don't want to perpetrate it. And I see a lot of fear-mongering going around, you know, related to this coronavirus. So what was going through your mind when you asked me, you know, about those two topics?
Well, I have taken to trading independently, specifically on the VIX, the volatility index. So my headspace is very much sort of with the short-term mainstream zeitgeist. And given that I was had skin in the game trading around the coronavirus, which was moving the markets, and I'm very sensitive to like levels of fear and concern. It was on my mind all that day, and I was on Twitter absorbing information. So at the end of being in that mind space at the end of the day to see a video about a new sci-fi TV show, which I saw the first episode, and it's definitely worth watching. It was just like, well, what about that one? This is what everybody's talking about. And like, I was actually personally feeling a little bit of anxiety about it. So it struck me as incongruent. And, you know, that's actually what I felt and thought in reaction to your video. So I thought, you know, you and I have known each other long enough that I could give you my sincere reaction.
Well, you didn't put in enough emojis because I didn't know what your intention was, actually. Are you a Nicholas Nassim Taleb fan?
I listened to his audiobook, Fooled by Randomness, mm-hmm. and I'm aware of Anti-Fragility. And he's one of those authors who I hear a lot of words and interesting concepts, but they sort of go one ear and out the other. They don't sink in. So I'm aware of his existence. He's probably a lot smarter than me, but I can't say that I've grokked, you know, the ideas that he's putting out there.
He's probably best known for his book, The Black Swan, but he gets his perspective is that of a trader. You know, he was risking mm-hmm. his own fortune and livelihood every day as a trader. And one of his more recent books is titled Skin in the Game. And I noticed that you had used that phrase in describing your experience as a trader. So I was just wondering how much of Taleb you would be channeling. And it sounds like not much.
Well, actually, Taleb, I think, comes from the same world that I'm now immersed in, which is the options trading world. So stock options are really all about, well, stock and other options, because you can have options on commodities like oil and gold. It's very much, it gets reduced down to probabilities and risk. So I follow a group out of Chicago called Tasty Trade. And they put out content every day on their live stream. And when you get into the options world, you're dealing more in probabilities and risk, and very much the topics that Taleb covers in his books.
Well, if you are trading basically based on the sentiments and the anxieties of the general public, then yeah, it totally makes sense to pay attention to what's in the news. I tend to think that what's in the news, or at least at the top of the news, is the smokescreen obscuring what's actually happening.
Yeah, I actually like to call the news the recent bad news rather than the news, because I never turn on the radio and had somebody tell me, over the past 10 years, more than 1 billion people have been lifted from extreme poverty in India and China. Like, you never turn on the radio and hear that now even sub-Saharan Africa, the majority of the adults have smart cell phones and can send money to each other through an app. Like, you have to, that is not presented to you at the top of the pile. So it seems that journalists still have a very strong taste for the sensational, the shocking, the slightly troubling. And so if your worldview is taken from the top headlines and what's presented to you on radio, you have a constant sense of alarm. I actually discovered the sort of the optimists, like Steven Pinker and the fellow who wrote the book The Rational Optimist. And that marked a change in my tone, because I followed along with you. I discovered you because of peak oil. So I got into peak oil back in 2006, and I had a good job in the city, and read a few articles and very well-researched publications about the inevitability of industrial collapse. And I left to work on an organic farm in the hills north of here. Left my good job because I was quite certain that it was imminent. And as you know, events played out that sort of fed that narrative for those who were waiting for it to come around. But then, of course, nothing did happen. You know, the price of oil went up to 150 and then came down precipitously from there. So I eventually decided to drop that because it wasn't worth the anxiety and the level of tension and the life changes. It's very, very parallel to you. You know, the life changes did not lead to any appreciable return on investment. And then I discovered
that had a big opportunity cost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I discovered people like Pinker, and I can't recall the name of the author who wrote The Rational Optimist. But then I came to see, you know, generally I did come around to the view, and also it just feels better for one's mental / emotional health to have an optimistic outlook, even if that's irrational. It serves me better because the world is very dynamic, and there's a plethora of information. You know, one can never get a full picture of what's going on because there's too much going on. There's no reason to believe that my worldview is correct. In fact, I know that my worldview is inaccurate because it cannot possibly encompass reality. So why not prefer a worldview that may be true and also leaves me with a more balanced, emotional orientation. So that's a long-winded way of answering your question.
That includes a lot of relevant information. And Matt Ridley is the author of The Rational Optimist.
Very good. Yeah. So I pay more attention to people like that. And I look at more medium and long-term trends to see how the world is going. And there's definitely, you know, concerning things like Australia being on fire for the past 3 months, but there always have been. And you know, one never knows how these things are going to turn out. I think we are emotionally, our biology inclines us to overreact to fearful events, because that one time there really is a tiger hiding behind the tree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Evolutionarily speaking, there is an advantage to, you know, defaulting to response as if you're in danger when you're really not.
Yeah. So given that we have that programming, we in our DNA, we could use our cerebral cortex to offset that. So it's, but with more positive thinking, with a more optimistic outlook. How's Mocha doing?
She's being quiet right now, which is a gift, but she's just a few feet away from me. She's curled up in her usual spot on the couch.
Is she a full-time indoor cat?
Yes. Yes, she is.
I see. I was living in the Laurentians, which is very ancient mountains, just an hour north of Montreal. They're very rolling because they've had glaciers pass over them like 5 times. And I had a cat up there that I got as a kitten, and it lived its full time as an indoor outdoor cat, coming and going and being in the mountains. And when I moved back into the city, she disappeared after like 3 weeks. He was so adjusted to living in the mountains, and he had lived his whole life in the same place. He didn't have experiences of moving. So after a while, he just gone. But he was like a mountain cat. Like everybody who saw him, he was very virile and very muscular because of living in the mountains all the time.
Well, Mocha has discovered that sometimes there are interesting things to be seen on my tablet. You know, my tablet, my little 10-inch Fire tablet from Amazon, is my TV. And there's cat TV channels on YouTube, you know, just birds and squirrels and things. And sometimes I put those on and she will watch attentively and, you know, make lunges at the screen. And sometimes when I'm watching stuff, she will, you know, nose her way up onto my lap and then turn around and just check out, you know, what's on screen to see if there's anything there that she might want to kill.
Anyway, those instincts are strong in them and in all of us.
They are.
And I'm glad that they're channeled in the humans in mass rituals such as the Super Bowl, which is happening today.
I know. I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, so I'm obligated to watch the Super Bowl. I normally don't, but I will this year. Let's go to impeachment. I mentioned at the beginning that you're in Montreal, so you are not a citizen of the United States. But I guess the whole world is watching this show. What are your impressions?
My take is that constituents that are represented by the Republican Party, for the shorthand, I call them the white male patriarchy, the white Christian patriarchy, and the oligarchs. I think that those are the constituents, or that is who the Republican Party represents. And I think they are on their back feet, that group. I think they're demographically disadvantaged at this point. And so the Republican Party needs to start playing dirty in order to stay in power. So they can't, an honest, transparent, truly democratic electoral system will lead to their ultimate loss of power. And they know that, so they have to take every advantage of the fact that the offices that they still currently do hold to game the system, so that they can stay in power. And I fear that many of them are trying also to change the system to make it less democratic, you know, via gerrymandering and appointing loyal judges. loyal Republican judges, as many as possible in the system. So people like Mitch McConnell, especially, and others are working the system to arrange it so the Republicans can stay in power despite all the demographic advantages. And I think that's what we're watching playing out. And it makes me very despondent to see it happening. I also think that in an oligarchy, oligopoly, in a system where wealth, money, having access to money buys you a lot of power, loyalties, money becomes something that one that transcends national patriotism. So that's why they've made unholy alliances with the Russian billionaire class. So this is what I'm seeing playing out, and the impeachment trial is just one piece of that, designed the way it's being gamed by the Senate Republicans is to keep their loyal Republican president in power. And I enjoy watching, when one watches any game, be it like a physical game of a sport, it's always interesting to watch how the different players play the game. So it's been fascinating to watch Nancy Pelosi and the tactics she's using, and watching people like Adam Schiff arise and hearing his speeches. It's always interesting during these moments of great tension to see how different human beings respond and which figures emerge to rise to the challenge. So I've been enjoying Adam Schiff's speeches and his eloquence in the Senate when he's making his defense, making the case for the prosecution.
That's interesting, because while I hear his name mentioned from time to time, I have no idea what he looks like. I have no concept of the sound of his voice. I just have no patience whatsoever for this whole fiasco. And I, every time there is some mention of it on my my NPR, I get it through the Amazon Echo, and I just say, the device's name, next.
I see.
I can't be bothered with the details. It just seems so dishonest and so opportunistic. It seems I have no sympathy for the Republicans. They have brought it upon themselves with the frivolous impeachment of Bill Clinton back in the 90s. But this to me seems like a completely bad faith, opportunistic attack just of opportunity. And I really take exception to the idea that the Republicans represent white Christian traditionalists, because white Christian traditionalists have been sold out by the Republican Party my whole life. Both the Democrats and the Republicans represent money. They represent people in power. There are different factions of the power elite, and the tech billionaires tend to align with the Democrats, and the defense contractors and fossil fuel, plutocrats tend to align with the Republicans. But it's demonstrated, factually, time and again, that the interests and desires of non-billionaires in the United States, regardless of their skin color, regardless of their religion, regardless of their political or social orientation, don't mean anything. They mean nothing when it comes to determining policy in this country. Mm-hmm. The desires of wealthy people mean everything. So when you say white Christian patriarchy, patriarchy means rule by fathers. And I really bristle at the idea that the problem in this world is fathers.
I see. Well, that's what I see when I look at the Senate Republican. That's physically, in terms of the demographics, that's what I see for the most part. But I do take your point is well taken. And I something that I want to say about it is in terms of the voting base, they do require a base of voters, despite who the powers are behind each party. They do need to attract hundreds of millions of voters to them, so they appeal to a different set of the electorate to get them into power.
Yeah, there was a shift in the 50s and 60s where previously the Democrats had owned the South, and they had done it through race baiting and openly racist rhetoric. And in the 60s, they sort of switched places. The Democrats gave up the racism and they started to embrace social progressivism and lost the South as a result. And the Republicans, you know, as a move of opportunity, took up that abandoned line, you know, the line that the Democrats had abandoned. And now the Republicans have ruled the South for most of my lifetime. But, you know, plenty of black people in the South and they tend to vote very conservative. You know, that's the only reason that Joe Biden is any sort of viable candidate is because in red states with large black populations, you know, those voters favor Biden, who is to me indistinguishable from a Republican, except in a couple of talking points. But, you know, he's pro-war, pro-big business. You know, he is an enemy of ending the drug war. He is an enemy of Medicare for all. You know, he's, to my way of thinking, you know, when I look at the policies that he endorses, I see no meaningful difference between him and Mitch McConnell.
I was having a conversation yesterday. It started heated and then it became civil with Josh, who is another Sea Realm listener from Montreal. And I was saying how in Canada, there was a party of the West, Alberta, called the Reform Party. Mm-hmm. And the West is where Alberta is one of the large Western provinces. And that's the Texas of Canada. That's where we have the Calgary Stampede. And that's where the oil and gas industry is seated. And they merged with the Progressive Conservatives. So power has been centered in Canada.
That's a lovely, lovely faction title. Conservatives.
Those were the two factions of what we called the Laurentian elite, which is sort of like the Northeast in the U.S., Montreal, Ottawa, and Toronto, the Laurentian elite. So the Progressive Conservatives merged with the Reform Party of the West to become the Conservative Party. And then what happened is it seems now that the Reform Party that is now in control of the Conservative Party, those Western, largely Christian group from the West now seem to have control of the Conservative Party. And I was wondering if the same thing might start playing out something similar within the Democratic Party, which, because it's obvious the left wing is gaining some momentum within the Democratic Party with Bernie Sanders possibly in the lead. He might win on tomorrow at the Iowa caucus and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Was that a middle finger or crossed fingers?
Crossed fingers.
Okay.
No, I definitely want Bernie to win tomorrow. I mean, my candidate is Andrew Yang, but I am under no illusions that he's going to win.
I think this fissure has to play out between the left-wing contingent and the corporate Democrats, because I don't think that they're really compatible. So I'm curious. I'll be interested to watch how that will play out over, say, the next 6 years or so, the left wing versus the corporate Democrats. And I think demographic, although, you know, I don't know for sure, but I think the demographic tendencies support people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez versus the Bidens. So
nice roll of the R there.
Thank you.
I am pining to move to Puerto Rico. So I've been watching, you know, Learn Spanish YouTube channels and reading reviews of different Learn Spanish apps.
I spent last February in Oaxaca, Mexico. And I often wonder, why don't I spend every winter here? And I think that's another thing we have in common is I turned 50 in 2019. And And I notice winters become less and less tolerable with each passing year as I get older. And with every year, the thought, what am I doing here, gets louder and louder. And when I do spend time in the South, it's like, why don't I spend more time down here? So I totally feel you. My exit plan is to move to Taiwan because I spent time in Beijing, China for a year, learning Mandarin Chinese as part of my university education. And some of that I spent living in Taiwan. And I've developed quite a strong affinity for that country. And I also think they represent a great hope for the Chinese people as a whole, because they're developing quite well as a democratic society that embraces human rights and diversity. And it's just a lovely place with generally cheerful people. So that's my exit plan.
I've been to Taiwan, but I never left the airport. It was just a layover.
Okay. Well, I think places like Hong Kong and Taiwan are very important for China as a whole, because the Communist Party of China does not represent the totality of the Chinese people. So these alternative examples of what China can be, I think, are very important.
Yeah, I sometimes think that I don't really remember. I remember the announcement, but I don't remember the negotiations that led up to the UK announcing that it would be giving Hong Kong back to China. To me, though, it seems that they have abandoned the people of Hong Kong. And it's strange to me to see the protesters in Hong Kong waving American flags. I would think, you know, they'd be waving British flags and saying, hey, China has violated the deals of this transfer. It should be null and void. We should remain, you know, under British rule, or at least a British system.
I think it really comes down to the size of your navy and your ability to project power, and also how much does it pay to get into those conflicts. There was a time where it was very profitable for Britain to have Hong Kong, and they had I think China didn't have much of a navy to speak of. So apparently it was a meeting in 1984, because mortgages, people started to realize, you know, mortgages, if you have a 20-year mortgage, people started to realize that their mortgages would be expiring after the British lease expired, if you entered. So that's when it came up, and people started pressing the British government for answers. What's going to happen after your lease with China expires? And that's when they opened negotiations with Deng Xiaoping and his government. And he basically said, if you don't leave, we're sending in the People's Liberation Army. And the British weren't about to, you know, go to war over a former colony after they've been decolonizing the entire empire. So apparently the die was cast, or everything was decided, in the mid 80s.
Well, given the value of real estate in Hong Kong, it doesn't surprise me at all to hear that that was, you know, pivotal in deciding the fate of that former colony.
So I heard you mention the word precariat yesterday.
In the video?
Yes.
And what did that spark for you?
It made me realize that I'm a member of the precariat class.
It's strange to hear that a member of the precariat is options trading.
It's my last best hope for rocketing myself out of it. I do have a little pile that I'm using, and you know, it's always awkward to talk about one's precarious position, but there's reasonable reasons to hope and expect that this could be my shot, man. This could be my shot.
How long have you been doing it?
Actually started options trading in 1997.
Oh, so you're not new to it.
I'm not new to it, but I took a course at a university up here about it, and it's quite fascinating to me, because basically there's two kinds of contracts. There's a call contract. So a call contract is, I wrote it down so I could say it. A call contract is allows you to buy something at an agreed price. The holder of the contract, so the seller is forced to sell it to me at a more favorable price. So if you owned calls in gasoline at $2 and gasoline was selling at $3 a gallon, you could use your call contract to force the holder of the gasoline to sell it to you at a more favorable price.
And a put, turn around and sell it at market price, right?
That's right. So your call contract, you'd have a dollar profit from the difference. And a put contract is the same thing, but it's held by the seller. So I could force you to buy something from me at a higher price than the market price. And so there's these two contracts, and you could either sell these contracts or buy these contracts. So that's four permutations. You can buy and sell call contracts and buy and sell put contracts. And there's a whole spectrum of strike prices. It could be $1.50 a gallon, $2 a gallon, $2.50 a gallon, $3 a gallon. And there's an expiry date, just like a coupon. So after, let's say, February 28th, this contract is no longer valid. So there's a time portion to it. So it allows for a symphony of combinations. It's like, I view it as sort of like a keyboard. You can combine these things to form all sorts of different strategies. And so because of the diversity of strategies, and it's fascinating me for quite some time, but it's kind of like for me in 97, it was like giving a teenager the keys to a Ferrari and or an F1 vehicle. And sort of I smashed that into a wall during my first attempt. I think what killed me was I bought calls in Netscape because I thought, Netscape, I use that all the time. There's no way. There's no way this can stay down forever, and so that got me out of the game during my first go around. But I'm much more cautious now, and I focus on trading the volatility index. Mm-hmm. So the volatility index measures the degree of change in the prices. So if prices are stable, if the stock market is stable and things aren't changing much, the volatility index is low. But once the price starts to swing either high or low, the volatility index goes up very high. So right now we're in a volatility spike. These spikes usually last at most 3 weeks. And right now the volatility index is spiking because of the coronavirus. And because of the nature of human fear, as we were saying before, the markets tend to overreact to these events, and things tend not to be as bad as people initially think. So the spikes tend to come down. So what I do is I enter positions that benefit from the spike coming down. So I short the volatility index, and I focus just on that. I don't play around with the Netscapes of our time, or I don't play around with that. You know, trying to speculate, I just focus on that one idea that the volatility spike will be short-lived, that the world is not going to end because of the coronavirus. We haven't entered a zombie apocalypse here. But on Friday, the market was reacting as if that was the case. So you just have to wait it out. And the problem is that the market can continue to be fearful for a while, but eventually the dust settles.
I can't get too technical because this is certainly not my area, but what's the advantage of playing the volatility index as opposed to, say, at a time when a solid stock has dropped in price because of mass panic, just buying shares of the stock and waiting for it to rise in price again?
Because it might not rise in price, the shares of that stock. And also the volatility index, when the fear starts coming out of the market, it's like it falls off a cliff. So when you short it, the degree of the fall is very acute. And also it's very reliable because it's always happened in the past. So if you're dealing with just one particular stock, there's many factors that could come into play. Like the CEO might smoke a joint on the Joe Rogan podcast. or there's many individual things that can affect it. Whereas when you're dealing with such something as vast as the volatility index, which is based on the S&P 500. And also it's always behaved this way in the past. So you have these decades of data to show you that this is what happens. So that is my answer to your question.
You know, it's funny when Elon Musk supposedly smoked dope on the Joe Rogan podcast. I know that straight people, square people, you know, saw that as, oh my God, he's getting high with Joe Rogan. But me, a lifelong pot smoker, I saw that as, here's the nerdy kid trying to look cool by taking a hit off a joint, and he can't inhale. There's no way he got anything from that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, no smoke came out of his mouth. He did not inhale anything.
You know? Yeah, I noticed that. He did the Bill Clinton move, which is moderate.
I think Elon Musk really wanted to take a hit of, you know, weed with Joe Rogan, but he just didn't know how.
Which is moderately surprising, because I think Elon's been to Burning Man a few times, and joints often get passed around at Burning Man. They just did a little takedown of Joe Rogan on the media on NPR this morning.
I'm sure.
They painted him as being similar to Gwyneth Paltrow, because at the beginning of his... Yeah, because you know what, you know how many podcasters fund their podcasts by selling ads? Mm-hmm. There's a chunk. And so his ads tend to be about health and performance, like exercise products and supplements. That's what he pushes for the first 10 minutes, those kind of products.
Interesting. I've only heard him advertise the Cash App, or as he calls it, the motherfucking Cash App, and Me Undies. You know, I was listening... when I don't listen to Joe Rogan regularly, and usually when I hear him, it's just a limited clip on YouTube, because I don't have 3 hours a day to listen to Joe Rogan. But when Andrew Yang was on, you know, I heard that episode. When Tulsi Gabbard was on, I heard that one. When Bernie Sanders was on, I heard that one. And each time he was advertising the same things. It was the Cash App, Me Undies, and what was the other one? Some other financial, you know, basically banking for the unbanked, you know, replacing mainstream sort of middle-class financial services with app-based services for the working poor.
I just found it unjust and telling that they would take the ads that he runs at the beginning of his episode, of his mm-hmm. episodes, as evidence of, you know, the kind of person he is, because you don't take money from unethical advertisers, but at the same time, I wouldn't make judgments about a person based on, you know, every company that he accepts advertising from. But it was front and center in their piece.
Depends. I mean, if he was taking money from, you know, the Sackler Group, I would be pretty pissed off at that. But
sure.
Doug Lane did a Zero Books video a few days ago where he was addressing the controversy over Joe Rogan saying he'd probably vote for Bernie Sanders, and the Sanders camp treating it as if it were an endorsement. And so many, you know, people on the righteous left demanded that Sanders renounce Joe Rogan's endorsement, which, you know, wasn't an endorsement, because, you know, Joe Rogan is a racist. And, you know, I'm sure anybody who's looked at YouTube has seen at least the thumbnails for Joe Rogan clips. He has a distinctive background. He's sitting at a microphone, you know, at a table. Behind him is a red brick wall and a tastefully faded American flag on the wall. It is professionally lit. A set designer basically created that setting for the podcast. It is very iconic, very familiar. And the piece that they, you know, they found that demonstrates, you know, Joe Rogan's racism, it's like him and two other guys, they're not in the same place. The lighting is crap. It's obviously very old. He doesn't look anything like he looks now. And he tells a story about a driver taking him, you know, when he and some friends asked to go to a movie theater, and they wanted to go to one in a good neighborhood. And the driver took them to a movie theater in a black neighborhood, and everybody in the theater was black. I would feel uncomfortable at such a theater, but you know, Joe Rogan described it. He used some off-color language, and then immediately, before he even took another breath, he caught it and he said, "Oh, that was a racist thing to say. That was dumb." So, they had to go back many, many, many years to find an incriminating clip, take just a little piece of it, And then ignore the fact that, you know, Joe Rogan was just talking with his friends. They were all high. And, you know, he immediately realized that what he said was, you know, in bad taste and took ownership of it in the moment. He has done thousands of podcasts to overlook the vast majority of, you know, the body of his work to find that one moment where he said something that was admittedly dumb and in poor taste. And then, you know, discount the fact that Joe Rogan was immediately conscious of what he'd done. To me, that is just so symptomatic and so indicative of the dysfunction of the left. I mean, just the enormous purity testing that goes on the left. Joe Rogan is the most popular podcaster in the world. I mean, he is a kingmaker these days. Every Democratic candidate's campaign staff reached out to Joe Rogan to try to get their candidate on the Joe Rogan podcast. So, you know, and he rejected them all except for Sanders, Yang, and Gabbard. And, you know, to then turn around and say, oh, well, you can't take any boost from that guy. He's a horrible racist. It's just, to me, it is so insulting to the intelligence of anybody listening.
So who are you voting for? No, I'm just kidding. I'm joking. Yeah, hilarious. Boy, what a whirlwind you're in, huh?
Strange. Mm-hmm. Strange to watch it take place because it's so obvious what it is.
I know.
They're using me to make him look bad that he supports me or that he used my endorsement.
Right.
I had no idea they were going to do that either. The Bernie Sanders people and all I said is I'm probably going to vote for him. I said I like Tulsi Gabbard. I really love her. I love him. I love Andrew Yang. Those are the people that I think like.
Look,
here's a really important point. I'm a fucking moron. If you're basing who you're going to vote for president based on mine,
right.
Like what I like.
I know.
I'm not that balls deep into this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not the guy.
Very strange. And this is a little out of left field, but how much of this is based on your look? If you weren't a muscular, bald headed white guy, I don't know if this would be. I bet this would be a different game.
Well, it's easy to paint me as a douchebag.
Right.
And also, what's really funny is the thing that I said in the video was exactly what they did. I said, if you just take the worst aspects of someone, take out everything else, magnify it.
Right.
And, you know, you could paint them out to be a real piece of shit.
Of course. I have 10 texts today.
But what I said is that it's hard to do that with Bernie because he's a really consistent guy.
He's the real deal. He was out in the front lines in the 60s with the civil rights.
Right. Getting chained to people and getting arrested. Yeah.
Right.
He was. That doesn't mean he's going to be a great president.
No, of course not.
I don't know what's required to be a president. I really don't. And I don't understand what's required to make sure the economy functions correctly. And also, I don't understand what's required to make the military function correctly.
No.
It's just guesswork. I mean, maybe we're better off with Trump. Maybe we're better off with someone else. I don't know. But what was fascinating to me was that these people, like fucking CNN, printed something saying that I was homophobic and transphobic. And there's a clip that they're using that's completely out of context. That the only – look, as far as trans people, some trans people listening to this, I got nothing but love for you, for everybody.
Yeah. Well, they're just looking for shit to pin to you. That's all.
It's to marginalize him. And it's also people that don't want anyone who's not woke to represent anything on the left.
Yeah.
If you're going to be on the left, there's a lot of people. Well, first of all, I should say this. Before I say anything about the blowback, the positive side, like the support that I've gotten from people because of this has been overwhelming and really heartwarming.
Mm-hmm.
From so many, from great comics and scientists and people that I've had on the podcast. Psychology Today wrote an article about how the media is gaslighting you on me.
Yeah.
Like they're trying to paint this guy out to be this monster. Like, have I said stupid shit? 100%. I've done 1,400 plus podcasts, a lot of them high. A giant percentage of them. I said a bunch of stupid shit. I couldn't even believe why I was saying it. I like to say inappropriate words. I do it all the time.
Same.
Why? Because it's fun.
Yes.
Because we're comics.
And it might hurt some people. Yeah, but some people like it.
I like saying words you're not supposed to say sometimes. But it doesn't mean I'm homophobic or racist or sexist or misogynistic or transphobic. These things aren't true. I love everybody. Like, literally, if you're a nice person, I will love you.
Yeah.
I'm cool with everybody.
But the weird thing is they want it to be true. Why? It's not even about the justice or helping people. It's about nailing
it. It's interesting because that was exactly his point in the clip that the Sanders camp extracted, which is that, you can go through anybody's history and find the blemishes and expand them and ignore all the good stuff that they've ever produced. And it's ancient wisdom from the gospel, which is like, let he who is out sin cast the first stone. Right. And I have a lot of compassion for my fellow human beings, because like I'm aware of my own sins and shortcomings. And I saw the same thing on Facebook with people talking about Kobe Bryant, because it looks like he had, there's a definitely documented case of non-consensual sex, which is a legally rape in his past, in 2003. And I heard there was somebody on Facebook calling him a rapist. I mean, for that incident, that one incident that we're sure of, that brush casts him in that person's eyes for the rest of his life. I have a lot of compassion for my fellow human beings and their flaws and weaknesses, because I'm aware of mine. And what it calls to mind is that when you have a political agenda, when you have an allegiance to a particular cause, you want that cause to win, which actually may be the correct approach. So people like Douglas Lane, he wants socialism to have more strength within the American political system. So much of the words that he produces are polemical versus I have no such allegiances, which is not necessarily laudable, but it allows me to be more focused on discerning what the truth is, because sussing out the truth harms one faction or another, it doesn't really affect, you know, my cause. But so I have the advantage of just being able to focus on what I consider to be true or not true, whereas other people need to promote whichever cause that they have an allegiance to.
People who listen to this podcast have a special window into the psyche of Doug Lane, I think, because when he comes on this show and we talk, we have fun. I always have fun talking to Doug. But he uses very, very different language here in the Sea Realm Vault than he does in his own media. And I think when I saw him do that vlog about Sanders and Joe Rogan, he seemed really, really uncomfortable to me, because this is how I projected, you know, this is what I projected into Doug, was that he is aware that his audience is far more inflexible and intolerant of divergent thought than he himself is. And he was trying to not step on their sensibilities, but at the same time trying to introduce, you know, a modicum of forgiveness and compassion and humanity into the conversation, but not be too overt about it, because, you know, those three characteristics are really not welcome on the ideological left, unless you're expressing them in a very formalized and particular way. But just to say, look, not everybody is consistently orthodox in their thought. And sometimes people say things which, you know, to the orthodox seems offensive. That was basically the message of his video, but he had to take like 5 minutes to say what I just said in a dozen words.
But if we grant that it's at least possible in the future that that could happen, especially, let's say, if Sanders becomes the president, then we have to ask about the harm that Rogan is said to have done. And this is, I think, where we can really find an error in the arguments about Rogan's endorsement. The truth is that Rogan's speech might be offensive, but it doesn't rise to the level of being harmful, or at least not harmful in the way that we usually want to condemn when we want to put limits on free speech, or when we want to ostracize people from society based on their speech. So one kind of speech that can be easily condemned is dangerous speech. Now, this is a technical term, or is one that's being developed as a technical term. And dangerous speech is speech that leads to violence against either a person, or the real context is against an ethnic group. You can see examples of dangerous speech in the lead up to the Rwandan genocide, for instance, and that speech that blames a person or group for social ills, dehumanizes a person or group, and then makes calls directly or maybe through dog whistles for people to act in self-defense and commit acts of violence against the ethnic group or person or religious group or group of people with a certain sexual orientation or so on. Now, Rogan has in no way advocated anything that amounts to dangerous speech. So Rogan has sometimes been insensitive. He's sometimes been disgusting, but he hasn't been dangerous. And he's, in fact, often spoken out against both crimes and immoral policies. As Ben Burgess and Michael Brooks wrote in their essay, in some contexts, ranging from Palestine to healthcare to Trump's child separation policy, Rogan has been a voice of reason and compassion. On that last subject, he's gone so far as to say that if you don't oppose what Trump has done to immigrants and refugees, if you don't oppose the separation of children from their families, you aren't on the team of the human race. And this is a real Joe Rogan show, a total mix of apolitical and political ideas, a mix of reactionary and progressive ideas. He is, in a sense, a representative of the political zigs and zags of most ordinary people who don't think and tweet about politics all the time or necessarily consistently. So let's take a look at one final argument. So just to put a cap on that, actually, the fact is that Joe Rogan is not dangerous. And to say that he has done harm in any political level or on any material level is a vast overstatement.
That was basically the message of his video, but he had to take like 5 minutes to say what I just said in a dozen words because, you know, he knows he could be canceled next.
Mm-hmm. And at that cancel culture, there's a recent ContraPoints video, which I highly recommend, in which she talks about how the cancel culture is contagious. So somebody gets canceled and you don't cancel them, then you're next in line. And if you don't cancel the one who was canceled because they didn't cancel, then
right.
So it's like a chain reaction.
At the end of the video, ContraPoints had to be very, very specific. There was nobody behind the camera. Nobody did any editing for me. I did this whole video. I did every job, start to finish. Nobody I know participated in the making of this video. Don't attack them, please.
Yeah. It does appear that when you insist on moral purity, you end up eating yourself. So the phrase "eat the left" does, we see that playing out. The left tends to eat itself.
Yes.
Because of its insistence on moral purity.
And yet, purity is supposed to be an obsession of the right.
There's a phenomenon in language where words flip in their meaning. It seems that the same thing applies in politics. And there was recently a Frontline documentary revisiting the 2016 election. It's always interesting when you have a bit of distance from historical events, you can develop some clarity. It's said that it's usually after 50 years, you can start to like think with clarity and without contemporary encumbrances about events of the past. But I found the Frontline documentary was interesting, and watching it, I came to realize I had an insight about what was happening with Trump in that he was demonstrating a nobody fucks with me attitude. Like, it came across as very courageous and brave. It was especially that moment where the blonde Fox News woman during the debate, the very attractive one, I forget her name, unfortunately.
At the time, Megyn Kelly was a star on Fox News.
Mr. Trump, one of the things people love about you is you speak your mind and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides, in particular when it comes to women. You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account
only
is
Rosie
several...
O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't. He knew I was going to hit him on something and he guessed it would be women and he got some line worked up. Fine, we forged forward. The convention center was laughing.
but I was going to get through the rest of my question.
For the record, it was well beyond Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
Your Twitter account has several disparaging comments about women's looks. You once told a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president?
What I say is what I say. And honestly, Megan, if you don't like it, I'm sorry. I've been very nice to you, although I could probably maybe not be based on the way you have treated me, but I wouldn't do that.
The way Trump sees media, the way he sees life, is all they like me or they don't like me. And in that moment, I got moved from the she likes me category into the she doesn't like me. And I believe that night the anger was real. His anger at me was real that night.
Thank you all very much. And that will do it for the first Republican primary debate night of the 2016 presidential race. Our thanks to the candidates. Well, no, but we're not done.
The man who had fed conflict on reality TV now had a much larger stage. And after the debate, he used it.
Donald Trump shows up as if he needed this hit of adrenaline before he went home to New York.
You guys okay?
Yep. Yes, sir.
Don't hurt yourselves.
It was like mosquitoes to a lantern on a summer night. I mean, the entire national press corps descended.
People were being trampled and camera equipment was flying all over the place. And I'd never seen a scene like this. I mean, I've seen many media stampedes, but nothing like that.
What's your history with Megan?
I think Megan behaved very badly personally.
The question about women, you didn't like that?
No, I thought it was an unfair question. They didn't ask those questions of anybody else. And I thought it was an unfair question. But you know what? The answer
is it was just the beginning.
Are you going to call Roger Ailes about it?
At 3:40 in the morning, he lit up Twitter.
Wow. Megyn Kelly really bombed tonight. People are going wild on Twitter. Funny to watch.
On the phone with CNN, he went further.
What is it with you and Megyn Kelly?
She starts asking me all sorts of ridiculous questions. And, you know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes. Blood coming out of her wherever. But
Trump recognized that it was a good storyline, and he kept fuel going under that fire. Because he knew some portion of his audience loved to see him challenging, you know, a powerful woman, never mind a woman at Fox. And so he accurately deduced that this would drive his numbers up with some segment of his base.
Trump had a powerful ally in the attack on Kelly, the right-wing website Breitbart, and its leader, Steve Bannon.
Fox has chosen a side. It's so evident in that debate that they're there to kneecap Donald Trump, okay? They're there to take him out. And that's when we go, okay, we run 20 stories on Megyn Kelly. I get Tony Lee and Matt Boyle, my two hammers. They go right after Megyn Kelly. We're going to Alinsky her, right? We're going to cut her out from the, call her out from the herd and just hit her nonstop. That's when all...
They couldn't have cared less.
Roger Ailes ran Fox News. Ruthless and powerful, Ailes was a force to be reckoned with.
Ailes calls me up and says, you got to knock off these stories. She's crying. She's all upset. She's getting death threats. I go, it sounds like a personal problem. I said, we're not backing off. We're gonna put more stories up tomorrow.
If Kelly can't take the heat, go back to the kitchen. Trump should commission a statue of Miss Kelly on her knees and place it in front of Trump Tower.
Under the onslaught, Ailes eventually backed down. He needed Breitbart, Bannon, and Trump more than he needed Kelly.
She called him out on his history of disrespecting women and his of slighting them and minimizing them. And then immediately he attacked her during the debate in front of everybody. And when people saw him standing up for himself, and it was like kind of like a prize. It was like a champion in a gladiatorial ring, like winning, like taking the head off of his enemy and like showing it to the crowd. And the crowd, it's a demonstration that I'm extremely strong and nobody fucks with me. Like not even her. Like I'm a winner. And so people like to back a winning horse. That's one of the things that Osama bin Laden said after 9/11. It's like when you see that somebody is winning winning and winning and winning and winning. It has like a snowball effect. And I think that's part of his mass, his appeal, is that you get a sense from him that if you support him, you're on the you'll be on the winning team. Are you looking up the name of?
I'm not typing. No.
I will. If you say it, I'll know it. But she lost her position. She's no longer where she was in 2016. But it also comes down to a question that I once heard about the source of power, because Mao is famous for have said that power emerges from the barrel of a gun. Mm-hmm. But if you think that forward, it would mean that the soldiers have the power, but that's not the case. So then it's he who can command the allegiance of the soldiers. And so who is that? It's not somebody with the bigger gun. It's somebody who has the personality and the force of character that will command the loyalty of the generals who control the soldiers, who control the guns. So I think it's characters like Donald Trump who can project that kind of confidence and strength, who can garner to himself the allegiance of the soldier controllers, and then accrue power to himself.
I was thinking of Joe Biden a few weeks ago. I think it was in Iowa. A nobody, you know, just a regular would-be caucus goer at a Joe Biden event, ask him a question about, you know, was it really a good idea for your son to use your name to make this money in a Ukrainian gas company when he has no expertise in that field and you were the vice president at the time? Was that proper? And the guy who was asking him was overweight. And Joe Biden just immediately leaped to insulting the guy about how fat and out of shape he was. And I remember the next day there were Joe Biden supporters and mainstream Democrats who tried to play that as Joe projecting strength. And for Trump to hit back at somebody who has a prominent position at Fox News who had attacked him, that is attacking, you know, another strong player. And to dethrone them with that counterattack does demonstrate, you know, power and confidence and strength. But for somebody like Joe Biden, the former vice president and Democratic, you know, anointee front runner, to use really cheap, you know, just really mean-spirited attacks on a guy who's raised a valid question, that to me doesn't seem like strength. That just seems like, you know, Joe is unhinged and has no tolerance whatsoever for any pushback. And man, I would never vote for Joe Biden. I don't want him to be the Democratic nominee, but the part of me that, you know, could go in for blood sport really wants to see Joe Biden debate Donald Trump, because Donald Trump will just work him over, you know, like he was a handful of Play-Doh. Joe will be bleeding from the eyes and sputtering and, you know, spouting incoherent nonsense in response to Trump's opening salvo. So, you know, it would be a catastrophe from my perspective if Biden got the nomination, but it would be a hilarious death spiral.
I don't think it would be worth four more years just for that moment, but your opinion may vary from mine.
Well, I'm not saying it would be worth it. I'm just saying that would be the garnish, you know, sandwich that we all have to eat.
Yeah, I often think that you can turn off the audio when the debates are on for a little while and just see what are they projecting as a character. What is the person from their facial expression, from their body language? And that's a very strong predictor, an element to consider in terms of who will win over, you know, popular support.
But after you've done that stretch where you're just watching the visuals and not listening, then it's good to listen and close your eyes.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Agreed.
Well, hey, you mentioned the, in relation to the other topics that we've talked about, the fact that you have been driving for Lyft or Uber, which one was it?
We only have Uber up here in Montreal. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I started doing that in 2015 because I mentioned that I could be considered part of the precariat class. But back in 2015, I was even more so. But thankfully, Uber arrived here and in our city. And at that time, it was 100% illegal. They just came in and flipped the middle finger to all the authorities here and started running their app. And
basically, following in the footsteps of Airbnb, who for a very long time their business model was just to say "fuck off" to local regulators.
Yes. It has something to do with the power of the smartphone, because everybody had them in their pockets, and it's amazing how that little device allowed for government power to be circumvented for a while until the government authorities could figure out how to grapple with it. But of course, these Silicon Valley technology companies were more nimble and agile in taking advantage of the technology. And so I was living up in the Laurentians, an hour north of the city, and I got a car that qualified for the service, and I would drive in and harvest money through the Uber app, and it was great. And because it was illegal, the drivers had networks, so it was a very interesting example of self-organizing, anarchic self-organizing. So we used WhatsApp and Zello to help each other hide from the finding agents. So
Zillow's a real estate app, right?
This is Zello.
Oh, Zello.
Zello. I really enjoy Zello because it's a push to talk. It's similar to walkie talkie. Mm-hmm. So I found it's a social media app that is based on the voice. And so you enter groups, you join a channel, and it's one person talking at a time. And it's based on the human voice. So it's much more personal, and there's more emotional content. And so the drivers, it created a Zello group and WhatsApp group, and we would use those apps to help each other avoid the authorities who were trying to catch Uber drivers. So they would go to like the bar street or the airport, the finding agencies in their vehicles, the inspectors, and they would try to catch Uber drivers. But every time we spotted them, we would let each other know. And there were even people going to the taxi authority headquarters and counting the vehicles that were in the parking lot, because we knew that they only had six. So at the beginning of every night, somebody would go and count them and then report to everybody, okay, all six are parked. Like, you know, we don't have to worry tonight it was that was a lot of fun. It was like cops and robbers, spy versus spy. Yes. Yeah. And then Uber negotiated with the government. The government realized that, the government kept on increasing the fines, but Uber would just hire lawyers to contest the fines and put them on the back burner, and the drivers would continue despite the fines. And so the Uber managed to get the government in a position where they had to negotiate with Uber. And so now it's completely legal. And now that it's legal, it's even more, there's even a larger client base, because it doesn't have this cast of being a black market underground anymore. So it's been a viable concern for me over the past 5 years. I think I have the same bug that many of us do, which is that I don't like to have my time bonded to an employer in terms of getting my income. So I like that. I like the independence that Uber affords me, despite the fact that the monetary rewards aren't that great. But I highly value being in control of my own time.
And in Canada, your access to healthcare is not tied to, you know, an ongoing relationship with an employer.
Not at all. Yeah, right. We have more socialism here. It's more like Bernie Sanders America.
Oh boy, I sure hope. You know, you mentioned earlier the psychological penchant for wanting to back a winner. I have voted for libertarian candidates for decades, absolutely certain in each instance that they would not win. And in 2016, you know, I backed Bernie Sanders against Hillary Clinton, pretty sure that he would not win. And now that, you know, Bernie Sanders is in the race and she is not, and he is actually leading in Iowa, I'm backing another guy who I'm absolutely certain will not win.
So I wonder how much you are, there's also a psychological penchant, because I was raised a Roman Catholic. And when I was young, I was very, what's the word for it? I was devoted. Like, I took Roman Catholicism. I wanted to be good. Like, yes, the character in Clockwork Orange. I wanted to be good.
Alex, like, DeLarge.
Yes.
Who did not want to be good. He just wanted to get out of prison.
At the end, that's what he was claiming, at least, to his people, that he wanted to the authorities. But I definitely had that desire, like, to be good, to be virtuous. And I think that still carries through. Like, I don't want to back the winner. I want to choose the right candidate. Like, I want to choose the one based on principle, not based on mere ideas of winning and losing. I want to be aligned with the grain of the universe and go with truth, justice, and truth, beauty, and goodness. So I think I still have that as a motivating influence in my life, aspirationally at least.
That's a respectable aspiration as far as I'm concerned. Well, Ed, we've been on for over an hour. Is there anything that you would like to say before we bring it to a conclusion?
I would like to say that, given that while you still live in Bellows Falls, I think you should come up to Montreal and get the fresh air of a country that is not your own, but still that you can operate in.
Does Amtrak go all the way up there? I'm without wheels these days.
It does come up here.
Okay.
Yes, it does. I think it's called the Appalachian. Come and check out a non-American country that's just at your doorstep. You're always welcome up here. And thank you for all the content you've produced over the years. You continue to engage me intellectually. And I've had a parasocial relationship with you, but I guess it's like somewhat more than just parasocial at this point, now that we've met in person and spoken face-to-face via Zoom. So
we've met in person twice. You visited here in Bellows Falls.
Oh, yes, I remember that. So thank you for all the content you've produced over the years. And if my shorting the VIX strategy works, I'll definitely sign on as a Patreon eventually.
Well, thank you. All right. Ed, have a good day, and I hope to talk to you again in the not too distant future.
Cheers.
All righty. That was Ed. And as usual, as I was editing that, I did take a few notes. And first, Ed mentioned that On the Media, and I have not listened to this episode. I really can't stand On the Media anymore, and I used to listen to that show religiously. But Ed mentioned that On the Media attacked Joe Rogan for advertising supplements, and I said I didn't know he did that. Well, as I was listening, it came back to me. I remember when I was living in North Carolina with Marty in the summer of 2017, and I didn't have any weed with me, and I don't sleep well without weed. And Joe Rogan, he does more than advertise. I think he's probably like part owner or an investor in a company called Onnit. And Onnit, you know, they have exercise equipment, and there's an Onnit Academy where they, you know, they teach exercise techniques. And they also have a line of supplements, and there was one, and I forget the name of it, but it included melatonin. And I've discovered since then that just melatonin by itself works wonders in getting me to sleep. It's not like weed in that it won't keep me asleep the whole night, but it'll at least get me there. And Joe Rogan, you know, was advertising that you can get a free bottle of Onnit's product. I forget what it was called, but it included melatonin and a few other things, and it was supposed to be a sleep aid. And, you know, so I signed up for it. I got the free bottle and it worked. And when the bottle was gone, you know, I looked at the price of getting a new bottle of it. And then I looked at the price of just buying some plain old melatonin, And melatonin's darn cheap, and the Onnit brand and its association with Joe Rogan was expensive. So, you know, I never touched another Onnit product. Not because I have anything against Joe Rogan, you know, capitalizing on his brand, but just to save money. Now, Ed said something about, you know, over the next 6 years or so, we're going to see the working out of this struggle between the left wing of the Democratic Party and the corporate wing of the Democratic Party. And I really think that it's important to carve out three subgroups in the Democratic Party. We've got neoliberal corporate Democrats, Hillary Clinton, Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, Joe Biden. You know, the status quo, you know, fully in agreement with the Republicans on a million things, you know, in their bipartisan consensus. The status quo Dems. That's one poll. Another poll are, yes, the leftists, the socialists. I guess there's actually four. We'll make it a four-quadrant graph. Another quadrant are, and, you know, forgive the crudity of this, this is a catch-all phrase, the SJWs. You know, the woke. Those who are exclusively focused on social justice issues and who are quick to turn on anybody and cancel and demonize and try to financially injure anybody who offends their sensibilities, particularly, and the people who are most vulnerable are the people who at one point, you know, profess to be allies and would still like to be allies if their number hadn't been drawn, you know, and, you know, they hadn't drawn the short stick in the lottery. But then the other quadrant, which is hugely important, and this is the one that I identify with, is the populist left. The people on the left who are saying, look, automation is eating jobs. Yeah, there's still lots of jobs in this world, but there aren't many career paths available to young people anymore. It's really hard for young people to buy a house, get married, have kids when they're saddled with enormous amounts of debt and there are no viable career paths open to them. And, you know, particularly in a world of escalating, spiraling, skyrocketing medical costs, where the default assumption is that your medical needs will be supplied by your employer. In a gig economy, that does not work. Well, the neoliberal, corporate, status quo, bipartisan consensus Democrats can easily accommodate the demands of the SJWs because all the SJWs want is to control your thought and speech. And the neoliberal Dems are happy to throw not just a bone, but a banquet to the SJWs. You know, I was watching the Super Bowl last night, and like so many people, even on years when I don't watch the Super Bowl, I do go to YouTube the next day and I watch a montage of all the Super Bowl commercials. Last night, and this is just from memory, I noticed that Sure, which is to say the antiperspirant, Olay, when I was a kid it was called Oil of Olay, but you know, it's a cosmetic line, and Microsoft all had commercials that used the same formula, which is to say that they showed women doing things that men are usually associated with. They showed men starting to get bent out of shape out of it and then accepting it. And then, boom, here's the product. There was another ad, and I laughed out loud at this ad. It was really well made. It was really enjoyable. It had some great surprises that I'm about to spoil. So if you haven't seen it yet, really, really, pause this podcast, go to YouTube, type in Super Bowl ad, Jason Momoa. Jason Momoa is Aquaman, you know, for sci-fi fans. He was a long-running character on Stargate Atlantis. I think he's most associated in my mind with, you know, Conan the Barbarian and Khal Drogo from Game of Thrones. But he is a masculine dude. He is a beautiful guy with beautiful hair, mixed race, you know, white Polynesian. He's just, you know, big, muscular, good looking, charismatic, funny, likable. And I loved his performance in this ad. He's also married to Lisa Bonet, Bill Cosby's daughter, who's a bit older than him. So, you know, a guy that beautiful, that famous could have, you know, he could have the arm candy, eye candy, young trophy wife of choice, and he's with an older woman, so good on him. But in the ad, he goes to his home, which is a beautiful home. He says, you know, I'm getting away from public life. My home is my sanctuary. And he comes in and he takes off his boots and he throws like one boot over his shoulder and it just lands, you know, in the foyer somewhere. And then he starts to walk into his house and the camera's tracking with him. And he continues to talk about, you know, the value of home and sanctuary and family. And he reaches over with, I think, his left arm and he grabs his right wrist and he pulls off his right arm. But what he really has pulled off is a muscular sheath that's on his right arm and underneath is a skinny arm. And then he reaches over and he pulls off his other arm. And now he's Jason Momoa, but with two stick arms. And, you know, he keeps walking and he starts to take his shirt off and then he pulls off his torso. And under his, you know, muscular, tight, athletic torso is this skinny guy torso. And he goes and he sits down on the couch and he takes out like this wooden instrument, a stringed instrument. I'm not sure what it is. And he starts to play it like a pedal steel guitar. And then he pauses and he reaches up to his beautiful, you know, long black hair and he pulls it off and he's bald on top, you know, and he's just got the fringe of hair, but long hair around the edges. And here's this guy who is this picture of masculinity. And over the course of 30 seconds, he has destroyed that picture of masculinity. His masculinity has been demonstrated to be a false front, and he's really this weak, unattractive figure. And then at the very end of the commercial, he's doing bench presses, but the bar has no weights on it. He's just pressing the bar. The bar weighs 40 pounds. I mean, that's not identified in the commercial, but I work out. I know that. And we don't see him ever complete one rep. He's just struggling to push the 40-pound bar up off his chest. And eventually he says, take it, take it, take it. And his wife, Lisa Bonet, is standing over him, you know, spotting him. And she reaches out with one hand and with no effort, you know, picks up the bar and puts it on the bench. So I like that Jason Momoa is willing to see his own image and to participate in the assassination of his masculine image. But at the same time, this was in the context of lots of very expensive, highly produced commercials, which in the process of elevating women, also, as is so common, you know, in advertising, they don't denigrate men. They just trivialize men and make men look petty and stupid and childish. And this is a long-standing tradition in advertising because most ads are you know, pitched at women. But what the ads, what I saw that was new in the ads was that men were expected to not only take it in stride, but, you know, to champion this message that masculinity is fake, that men are ineffectual, and that they should be subordinate to women, and that is their natural place in the world. Again, I'm not coming at this, you know, from the perspective of somebody who has staked out that message as their brand identity and can't vary from it, you know, can't look at other points of view. I can obviously look at other points of view. And as I say, when I saw the ad, I enjoyed it. I liked it. And I still like Jason Momoa. I like Jason Momoa more today than I did yesterday. And I really liked him yesterday. I liked him a whole lot yesterday. Okay, I'm not gonna dwell on that topic. Just was in my notes, thought I'd throw it out there. Okay, two more items on the list, and then I'll let you go. And I know a lot of you have all the time in the world, and you're not looking to be let go, but others are. And as soon as I get this podcast posted, I need to get to work on a comic strip. But I got an email today from Ben Bella Books. This is from Lindsay, who is their marketing director. She writes, "Hi there. I'm reaching out on behalf of James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency, and the upcoming release Living in the Long Emergency, Global Crisis, The Failure of the Futurists, and the Early Adopters Who Are Showing Us the Way Forward, as a potential guest for the C-Realm podcast. I know you've interviewed him before, and for some reason that is a hot link, and I haven't clicked on it. Where does that go? That goes to C-Realm podcast episode number 523. So maybe she knows I've interviewed him before. She doesn't know that I've interviewed him for like 13 years. Anyway, I won't read the list. She, you know, is describing who Jim Kunstler is and what he can talk about in an interview. It's obviously a form letter. What you may or may not know is that among the people that he had interviewed for this book is me. And I was one of the first people he interviewed. I don't know if I'm early in the book or late in the book or, you know, what role I will play. You do know that I'm not an uncomplicated supporter of James Howard Kunstler's message about the future. I think that artificial intelligence is going to play a role in the future, regardless of what happens around energy. But I fully plan on interviewing Jim again in the near future. And if I go to his house to do it, as I have done, you know, in the past, then there's plenty of opportunity to record lots of material. I'll get some for the main Sea Realm podcast, some for YouTube, and some here for the vault. And, you know, as is the case, typically we save the juiciest stuff for the vault. So you have that to look forward to. All right, I'm happy now, but just broaching the next topic is going to change that. Those of you who listen to the Psychedelic Salon podcast and who are caught up know that Queer Ninja, the host of the Sounds of Worldwide Weed, somebody who was podcasting before I was, and somebody who was dear to me, died a week ago yesterday. He had struggled with heroin addiction, and I'm ashamed to say we had been out of touch for so long I didn't know that. I'm told that at the time of his death, he had been clean from heroin for 50 days, and that he died in his sleep. All of that is entirely consistent with relapse overdose, which is to say, you know, if you're a regular user of opiates and then you stop for an extended period, the tolerance that you had developed when you were using regularly goes away, and the amount that you used to take just to get high is now a lethal overdose. I don't know if that's what happens, and honestly, I won't say I don't care. I'm curious, but it doesn't matter whatsoever in terms of how much I love the guy. And how much it hurts that he is dead. And Lorenzo has invited me to talk about this on the Psychedelic Salon podcast, and right now I just can't. Here I am talking to the Sea Realm Vault audience. It's a much smaller, more intimate space, and I really can't talk about it. But if you don't know who I'm talking about, or if you haven't heard his voice in a while, I am going to share the last thing that I heard from him. Back in 2008, he set up an interview between me and Susan Blackmore, the author of The Meme Machine. She's somebody who's into cognitive science, but also psychedelics. That was an enjoyable interview. And Queer Ninja recorded this for me to play in that same episode. I won't say anything after this plays. So this is me signing off, but here's Queer Ninja.
Easy, man. This is Queer Ninja, a very excited Queer Ninja, I must admit. This is a fabulous day for me. I've been trying to encourage KMO to get in touch with Dr. Susan Blackmore for quite a while now. I had to take matters into my own hands because, you know, he was a bit of a slacker when it came to that. So, you know, I dropped Dr. Sue an email, and the rest, they say, is history. This is a big day for our community, guys, for all those who listen to the Sea Realm podcast, for all those who are interested in consciousness research, in mimetics. But also, I think that Dr. Sue is the kind of person that stands up for what she believes in. She spreads the truth as far as she sees it on things like entheogen use, on cannabis use, and she's not afraid to pull any punches, man. She, you know what I mean? She's like, I heard her on Radio 4 in the United Kingdom, and she was, you know, kind of up against lots of kind of people that were questioning her views on the, you know, the creative use of entheogens and stuff, and she does an incredible job. She is a hero of mine for sure, Dr. Sue. I've followed your work for a long time, and you know, I mean, it really is an honor that you're going to share some thoughts and time with KMO, who I think that we all respect as an incredible interviewer, and also as an incredibly insightful person. He can investigate concepts and ideas on a whole variety of different matters, man. You know, and KMO, we love what you do. And I'm very, very pleased that you're still doing it. So it's a privilege to say that Dr. Susan Blackmore and KMO are together at long last. the ninja's job is done. I can skip away now to my cave and, you know, hibernate for the next 1,000 years or something, saving the knowledge day. Finally! The incredible Dr. Sue is together with the incredible KMO. All right, this is Queen Ninja. I'm going to go enjoy the beautiful Scottish sunshine on this cold winter's day. And hopefully by the time I get back from the forest covered in trees and woods and stuff, there'll be a fabulous new CMO, C-Round podcast from KMO. I'm pretty stoned, as you can imagine. But I'm out of here before I ramble into eternity. And much love to everybody. Have a fabulous day, guys. All right.